the information we have received from multiple people in the community who are clearly interested in this issue. I am really overwhelmed at this point with the interest and the amount of information that has been forwarded to our offices. But really, we appreciate what you're doing, because really is the only way we are going to be able to put our hands around this issue and try to come up with some legislative actions that will hopefully help us deal with the achievement gap. I want to particularly thank the members of the councils, the minority councils that are here, the staff members and the Office of Ombudsperson for Families, and some of the minority advocates that are representing American Indian children and children of color in the audience today. We had a very good meeting recently to talk about putting together a memorandum of collaboration between the councils of color, the four ombudspersons of families, and other communities, community agencies that serve children of color. And this issue in particular is a priority. So we're looking forward to having a conversation with you as to what do we need to do in the state of Minnesota to deal with the achievement gap. But before we start this conversation, we're going to go around and introduce ourselves. There are some members of the committee that will be here pretty soon, so be patient with us as they come in. We will ask them to introduce themselves.
We're going to start. Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. My name's Chuck Weger. I represent North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, and I chair the Senate Education Committee.
I'm Senator Sharon Erickson Ropes. I'm from Winona, and I'm co-chairing this committee and also serve on the Education Policy Committee.
Shelby McQuay, I'm the research analyst for the Education Committees.
Rachel Hicks, and I'm the legislative assistant for Senator Patricia Torres Ray.
Tim Donahue, legislative assistant to Senator Sharon Erickson Ropes.
Thank you. I hope you have a copy of the agenda. If you haven't received a copy, please pick up a copy that is available to you. As we move forward and try to initiate a conversation, I realized really early that today we are not initiating a conversation. We are continuing a conversation, and we are enhancing a conversation that many of you are having. Many districts, many community organizations, many advocates, faith-based organizations, early childhood programs, researchers, universities are talking about this issue, and right now wrestling with this question of what is that we need to do in order to address the achievement gap. So the goal today is really to initiate this conversation from our end and try to open an opportunity and open the doors to perhaps a long-term conversation. As I read the research, I realize that many of you have done extensive work in this area, and it's not that we don't have ideas or we don't have recommendations. It's perhaps that we have many ideas, and that we really don't know how to put these ideas together to create a plan of action. Certainly, as we look at the statistics today in the state of Minnesota and the nation, we realize that children's success in school determines their success as adults, determining whether and where they should go to college, what professions they may enter, and how much they are paid, and how successful in general they are in life. So we see education as the great equalizer. However, in Minnesota, and the commissioner is going to come in a minute and talk about these statistics and present a clear picture of what is happening in Minnesota, I am attempting to put a report from my office that will tell you, will clearly show that we have significant problems in terms of creating a system of education that is a great equalizer in Minnesota. So according to the results that we got from the current MCA tests that were provided by the Department of Education, we see that in terms of proficiency, 69% of African American children were not proficient according to the current results, which are similar to the results we got last year. Only 9% of white children were not proficient. 65% of Asian American children were not proficient, and 58% of children were not proficient, and 70% of children of American Indian children were not proficient. This is just to tell you that we have significant gaps that we need to address in the state of Minnesota, and I would like to invite Commissioner Alice Sigrin to please talk to us about what you see, and if you could really elaborate on this. Unfortunately, Commissioner, we have not been able to move as fast as we can with our staff in our office to really be able to coordinate this, but we are looking forward to hear your presentation so that you can expand on this. And before you move, you go there, Senator Erickson Ropes is going to say a few words to the group, to the audience. Go ahead,
Senator. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, and thank you, everyone, for attending here today. I think in my conversations with Senator Torres-Ray about what we want to see happen here is we're very concerned about the achievement gap, as everyone is. And it seems that we've come across a plan that's over here that deals with this, and a plan here, and a plan here, and a plan here. And our hope is to put all the plans on the table, if you will, and see if there's a way that we can articulate some of the best components from all of them into a plan where we might be able to move Minnesota forward. We're both freshman senators, but I think we've experienced dealing with the silos that exist up here at the Capitol. Some of you, you know, are nodding heads and understand that. But we know that when we're talking about improving education, we're also talking about safe communities. And when we're talking about good schools and achievement gaps being more narrowed, we're talking about nutrition. We're talking about public health issues, and we're talking about family dynamics. So there's so many different pieces of what makes education succeed and education for our children succeed, that what we're going to try to do is put many of these different pieces of the grand puzzle, if you will, on the table and see if there's some ways that we can break down those silos and articulate across departments so we can get the best model possible as we try to deal with the achievement gap. So that's very glad to have the commissioner here with us today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. It's nice to be here today, and I certainly want to reiterate what both of you have just stated. And that it is really unacceptable for us to have this kind of a large achievement gap in the state of Minnesota. It has been something that has been going on for too many years. And as you have stated, we have a number of initiatives that go on and start up and then, you know, fade away because of grant opportunities. And sometimes there's not the consistency, but sometimes there's not the coordination of resources that we need to look at. And I want to give you one example. When Red Lake had its tragedy, the governor had called all of the agency heads together in an interagency task force, if you will, to respond, because we knew that public safety certainly had to be involved, but education had to be involved, human services, health, a number of agencies. And what we found out, and of course when it happened, I had not been commissioner for very long, and I was just very concerned about what we could do. And as we sat around the table and we brought our expertise from the department and all the other agencies did, we found that there were many, many resources available that we could put together to help Red Lake. And indeed, from mental health support to professional development for teachers to looking at special education needs to the list went on. We were able to put together a plan of action that really did help Red Lake now begin to look at in a much more efficient and concise way the needs that they have. And then we can, as different agencies, then come behind them and support them in the ways that they need. So it's an example of a potential success that is moving forward. Indeed, I was just with Superintendent Brent Gish this morning, and we were talking about how far Red Lake has come and the excitement and the energy that is now being generated because of this interagency work that has gone on and the ability to pull together our resources. And sometimes it's not about more. It's just about finding out what is available and helping people connect with them. We would certainly want to have the expectation that every Minnesota student should be proficient and graduating from high school. And one of the things I think that No Child Left Behind has done for all of us, for every state, is to really shine a light on the progress of our children, particularly our minority children that have struggled over the years. I think in the past we've all known that there's an achievement gap, but we have sort of worked with the students as much as we could, really did not have any goals or benchmarks for moving them more robustly through the system, but we tried to educate them and then move them to the next grade, and then slowly, year after year, children fell further and further behind. That's no longer the case with No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind says that every student has to meet 100% proficiency by 2014. Regardless of how utopian that is, now we have and we must set goals for all of our subgroups of children, and we need to measure their progress over time. So I think that that has been an important thing that has caused us to really then what we should be doing is digging deep into what we're doing to educate our children. How are we looking at the cultural relevance of what we're doing in the classes to meet them where they're at? And that's caused a lot of additional conversation and strategies that we should be looking at. And we haven't found the solution yet for all of this, but I think it has caused us to have much deeper conversations than we've ever had before. And it is holding us accountable and telling the public about that. I want to now just kind of go through some of the, you talked about the silos, and I'll tell you about our silo and the things that we are doing, but we're also trying to work more collaboratively across agencies as we do some of these things, but particularly at the Department of Education. I'll start first with certainly this last legislative session, we had some very positive things that happened. We are creating early education scholarships for our children that are 3 and 4 year olds, and that will be starting to be implemented in the next few months. Also, if you just look at our existing resources, in our formula, our own education formula, we have a compensatory formula that is tied to any increases in our general ed formula. That is approaching over $700 million of targeted resources that go to children who are in poverty and who are minority students and need additional support. And then we also appropriated money to support our teachers in the future around professional development. Our teacher math and science academies will be another strategy to come alongside of our teachers to help them as we're preparing for higher and more rigorous standards. And as you know, we are expecting more rigor and more relevance for all of our students as they go through the K-12 system. In special education, we have 2 grants with higher education institutions that are now researching culturally appropriate pre-referral interventions in special education, because we know that we have many students that are over-identified in special education, and we know that that is something that we need to start doing a better job of. We also are looking at guidance from our American Indian experts in regard to reducing the bias in special education assessments for American Indian and African American children. Now, this is all in special ed that I'm talking about. Now, beyond special education, we also have training and support for over 71 schools who are doing school-wide positive behavior intervention and supports, PBIS. We are finding that those initiatives are really having an impact on school climate, reducing anti-bullying and all the other kinds of things that make it less attractive for students to go to school if they're experiencing bias and teasing. We also have, thanks to the Senate and Senator Salzman, if she was here, I think she's going to be here, we have 8 pilot grants on RTI, Response to Intervention, which was a major initiative of hers this last session. And we also have large, we received a 3-year large grant for dropout prevention. And particularly 3 of those are focused on special education. And we're also trying to look at parental engagement. We also have multiple teacher networks and conferences for professional development that go on all through the year. We also have in Minnesota a lot of choice options for parents. And you all know the list, but I'll go through those just quickly. We have charter school options for parents, and we have over 120 charter schools in Minnesota to date. They do not charge tuition, charter schools. They are a public school. They do not set any admission requirements, which is like a public school. Any student is welcome. And they are one of the leading alternatives to traditional public schools now in the state of Minnesota. We also have many alternative programs for our children in Minnesota. They are programs which allow students who are at risk of not graduating to attend public and private non-traditional schools and earn a diploma. We have over 150 of these programs in more than 600 sites throughout the state of Minnesota. Most are focused on high school and adult students, but programs also serve K-8 students whose education might otherwise be at risk. And many programs combine academics and a vocational component also. We have online learning, which is a rapidly growing option, especially for our students in rural areas who may be isolated and cannot get the same full academic breadth and depth that other students can, perhaps in a metropolitan area. Open enrollment has been a way of life for a number of years. Over 30,000 of our Minnesota students take advantage of this every single year. So they do have the choice of going not only within their district, but to other districts if they choose to. And then we also have AYP Technical Assistance Adequate Yearly Progress. That is the terminology for No Child Left Behind, Adequate Yearly Progress Technical Assistance. And we have a school improvement division that has been created especially to look at staff development, teacher induction. It also supports our quality compensation program. We look at program evaluation of many of our programs across the state and education technology and technical assistance. Now, the program division that has school improvement, the school improvement charge, is to assist schools identified as not meeting AYP. And last fall, in 2006, we established regional AYP school improvement sites so that now we can deliver school improvement strategies and professional development around the region instead of, in the past, many of our school districts and their teachers had to come to Roseville, to the cities, if you will, to have school improvement support. And this is starting to really build capacity in our districts, and it's really able to connect more meaningfully with our districts. All the technical assistance that we delivered takes the form of high-quality professional development. We have ongoing evaluation of continuous improvement, and we have ongoing technical assistance. Also, we have our quality compensation program, which is also affording our school districts that are participating much more comprehensive, meaningful professional development and evaluation, where they're looking at the data of their students and actually being able to analyze it and developing the strategies that are necessary for help in school improvement. And I just want to go through some of the federal programs so that the audience is aware of those also. The biggest one, of course, is MCLB Title I, Part A, and we received just over $114.5 million for just the Title I program. We have approximately 422 districts and charter schools that receive Title I funds. The program components of Title I are a needs assessment to identify instructional needs. We have applications with goals aligned to student academic success, professional development opportunities for teachers. We have to provide strategies for parental involvement, and we have to use data to evaluate program implementation. The Title I program provides funding to the districts or schools with the highest concentrations of poverty, and it helps to provide supplemental services to all of the other things that are going on in the school. We also have No Child Left Behind Title III, Part A, which is English Language Acquisition, Language Enhancement, and Academic Achievement. And that money goes, as is obvious, to our English language learners. We have about $6.5 million that we received in 2007-08, and we have approximately 85 districts that receive Title III funds. Then we have Title I, Part H, which is our Dropout Prevention, Retention, and Graduation Initiative. We have about $2.5 million that we receive from the U.S. Department of Education to prevent dropout and also to increase the graduation rates. We also have received some other additional funds from other foundations that we're also trying to use to enhance our work in that area. We have seven funded sites. Right now they are Brooklyn Center, Red Lake, Duluth, Richfield, Hibbing, St. Paul, and Park Rapids. And these districts are collecting data on risk factors and predictors of dropping out versus school completion. We also are collecting data on the dropout and grad rates for each district that can be disaggregated by student groups. And the anticipated outcomes of this initiative are to decrease the dropout rate and correspondingly increase the graduation rate by year three in all of the buildings that are participating. The Dropout Prevention Initiative has five goals: to develop a comprehensive strategy to prevent dropouts from happening. We're to develop student-level and school environment assessment tools. So in other words, that we can disseminate to other schools as they are interested in this so that they can also implement effective programming. We also want to increase statewide and local coordination. So we're doing a cross-agency MDE team that meets regularly, and that is with special education, Indian education, school choice, academic standards, and high school improvement. But beyond our cross-agency or internal work that we're doing, we also have a steering committee of statewide organizations that are also working on the same initiative. And some of these organizations, St. Paul, for example, also is working with another group on dropout preventions, but we're coordinating and meeting regularly on to talk about the different strategies to see what we can compare and what we can learn from one another. And this steering committee consists of the Council on Black Minnesotans, the University of Minnesota Institute on Community Integration, the Kanapka Institute, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council, the PACER Center, the Ramsey County Office of Truancy Prevention, and there's others that, and as I mentioned, the St. Paul schools are involved in it too, and there's more. And also, fourth and fifth, to provide support and technical assistance for our local education agencies, our school districts, and also to increase the continued implementation of successful dropout prevention strategies across the state. Those are just a few of the things that we do every day, and there are more. As I said, we have more comprehensive programs that address all students, but we know that those will affect everyone as we're working through those. Our high school redesign retooling effort that is going on is also going to be looking at more hands-on relevant application of education for all of our kids, and we know that a lot of kids learn by doing things, by hands-on, and we want to start looking more robustly at that. Now, I just want to draw your attention to, we gave you a handout on the MCA 2 mathematics and reading results for 2007. And basically, as you can see, we'll go through those briefly, but from 2006 to 2007, we pretty much held steady with our NCLB adequate yearly progress results. When you look at the different percentages of students meeting or exceeding the MCA 2 reading, you can start to look at each grade level, 3rd through 10th grade. In 10th grade, we have our reading test, and you can start to look at the differences between the American Indian, the Asian Pacific Islander, Black, and you can go through those. I'm not going to repeat those scores for you. You can read those for yourself. But you can see that even across our grades, going from 3rd through 10th grade, all categories of students decline over time in the percentage of students that are meeting proficiency. So while we have our goal has been if all of our children, the majority of our children, are reading well by third grade, you know, it should mean that we're going to continue to see a steady percentage, and indeed we see it declining. So, again, sometimes we look at silver bullets to say if every student is reading proficiently at third grade, then that should guarantee that they'll do fine for the rest of their lives. But as you know, there are many things that we have to do to put in place consistently. Have early childhood support, have reading support that is going to get us to a basic proficiency in third grade, but that's not enough. We have to continue in our middle schools and in our high schools to make sure that there is relevance and support for students, particularly if they are struggling. There are just no silver bullets. Educating children is hard work, and we need to realize that, and we need to hold ourselves accountable as we go through all of our grades. As you see in mathematics, then, if you look at the same breakout, you can see the difference between the different groups. I will say that there's probably some, I think, really positive news in the Asian Pacific Islander group. I think that you can see that in the mathematics area, they are going to, they are maintaining our going to come close to the white majority population, and I think that is really a tribute to a lot of the hard work that has been done for our English language learners. Is particularly, we've had a lot of Hmong students that have come, and I think the work that Minnesota has done just in working with the language acquisition and understanding that they didn't come with a written language and that has been developed, and I think that has had a profound effect on what is happening, even just if you even looked and dug into the Hmong population, and certainly there are many other populations of Asian Pacific Islander groups, but it's one of the things that I think that is a good news story for us. So with that, I will stand for any questions that you have. If you would want to dig into any of our test score data later, we'll certainly be glad to bring some of our testing experts here if you want to grapple with that a little bit more. But today my message is basically that we are certainly committed as an agency to doing whatever we can to help support our schools, to go out, to look at school improvement strategies. We know that a lot of times curriculum alignment is one of the basic fundamentals that we find is not happening sometimes in schools that are struggling. And once that is done, things start to progress. But there are so many strategies, and they are individual to school and site and districts a lot of times. And it depends on the minority population that they may have a predominance in. So it's not simple. It's very complex. And I agree that it is not only education's responsibility to educate our children, but it is the whole community. And looking at additional, I think, even messages that we should be speaking as communities to really be saying to every child and every parent that we expect that our children can learn and will learn, and that education should be celebrated and it should be something that is desired is a very important message that we need to be consistently sending to all of our children as they are growing up. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. We would like to welcome Senator Sandy Rummel for being here. We really appreciate it. And Representative Willie Dominguez, we really appreciate that you came to hear this presentation. I have a question, Commissioner. If I hear your presentation today, the programs that you mentioned in your presentation are funded with federal money, predominantly 100%, all of them. Is the department or the state seeking funding, or have you made an effort to get state resources to have specific programs geared towards dealing with state issues and looking at how the state could have a strategy in place in order to respond to this issue? Or is this all funding that comes from No Child Left Behind initiative, and everything that we're doing right now, it's within the titles that fund those initiatives?
Well, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, one of the biggest resources of funding for our at-risk children is our compensatory funding, which is over $700 million. And that is tied to the funding formula. So every time our funding formula goes up, that money goes up also. So for, and then it also has a concentration factor, so that if you have concentrations of poverty, that money is then driven to those schools that have the largest concentration. So, for example, Minneapolis and St. Paul, depending on the site that you're looking at, could receive anywhere between $1,000 to $2,500 per student in additional money that is supposed to also be going to create the kinds of programs or strategies to help our at-risk population. So that is one of our largest components that continues to be funded. The other areas that I did mention are mainly federal funds that we use as resources. Again, we certainly look at opportunities to create strategies that can be ongoing strategies. But we basically really depended upon the local school districts to do what they needed to do within their own school districts to address the achievement gap based on the state money that is already appropriated to them. And then under the title programs, then we have the direction to also do more specific things under AYP.
Thank you. Any questions from the group? Thank you so much for...
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Do you think students that are not meeting expectations for various tests that we have, but primarily on the proficiency for math, language, should we have something akin to special education individualized plans for everyone so that there is an aggressive intervention that formally starts once we get information showing that they are behind? Because if there is not an aggressive plan, we're never going to come close to meeting the goals of No Child Left Behind. That's obvious in looking at this trend data. So what are we going to do to change the system?
Madam Chair and Senator Wigger, certainly that would be a strategy that would be something that we could look at, to have an individual plan for students that are, you know, a certain level behind, not eligible for special education services, certainly. One of the things that we are doing through the P16 partnership, we've had a remediation study that has been going on for a couple of years. And Jeff Mariama from the University of Minnesota has been in charge of that remediation study. And one of the things that we're trying to kind of hone in on is how do we do effective remediation? So it kind of gets to your question about, do we do an education plan for students? When do we do it? When do we start intervening? And, you know, as you look at even the reading scores here, you can see that, you know, if you looked at third grade, you could see that between 86 down to 57%, but almost 60% of our students are doing fairly well in third grade in reading. And we've heard this mantra for a long time that if kids are reading by third grade, that, you know, that's going to guarantee that they're going to be successful. But when you start looking at their progress over time, certainly reading gets harder, the comprehension issues become a little bit more complex. But we should, that should be one of the little guarantees. But it isn't necessarily what's going to happen. So it's sort of grappling with, when do you start, who do you identify, and how do you do the really good remediation? You don't want to do kill and drill. If it's just about getting them over the hump so they pass a test, that's not the way you want to do that. You want to really have very comprehensive remediation that is then going to really guarantee that they're going to be successful then from that point on. And it is, again, it's hard work. You have to just continually make sure that there's a lot of support for children, particularly if they're going to struggle year after year. But that, again, that would be a strategy. And districts can do that now if they wish. and some probably are doing similar things. We also, years ago, and I don't know what the status of it is, I think the funding declined over time, but we used to have Assurance of Mastery program too, and that was a strategy for looking at, you know, assuring that every student had mastery of now we call it proficiency, but a similar concept. So we've tried things in the past, and they're supported for a while, and then the funding fades, and I think that we just need to have, I think, more identified practice, and then I think you know better how to, you know, fund what you need to do. And I think this discussion is going to be very helpful as we, and I hopefully you will be bringing in some experts, you know, to talk about that. Reading First is an example of a big federal program. The University of Minnesota actually ran our Reading First program. And now, of course, the funding is going away for that, and districts are trying to figure out, well, now how do we sustain that work? Because it was pretty complex work. It wasn't real easy, you know, to teach these reading strategies.
Thank you, Commissioner, and your point is very well taken. I think everyone understands this is a very complex department to be working in, and a complex goal for us to narrow the achievement gap. So thank you very much for your presentation. And next we have the superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools here with us. Would you come to the table, please, and introduce yourself? And I'll just remind you, we'll try to stay sort of on a 15-minute presentation schedule. And at the end of the presentations for everyone in the room, we're going to try and do something a little bit differently since Senator Torres-Ray and I are interested not only in information that's being presented, but your thoughts and opinions about information being presented, that we'll be giving people an opportunity, for those who are here listening today, to add your opinions or observations at the end of the presentation. So you can prepare your comments as we're moving along. I'd also like to acknowledge Senator Saltzman has joined us at the table. Thank you much for being here today. And would you introduce yourself for the committee, please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maria Carr Starfin, and I'm the superintendent of St. Paul Public Schools in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Great. Our district serves more than 41,000 students, making St. Paul Public Schools Minnesota's second largest school district. Our student population is diverse, reflecting more than 70 languages and dialects, and our students arrive at our 66 schools with an array of educational experiences and skills. Our mission is to provide a premier education for all students, and I emphasize the word all. Overall, in St. Paul Public Schools, we are seeing pockets of improvement. We have reduced our dropout rate by half. Our English language learners are outperforming their state peers, and many of our schools are showing better performance than similar schools, including charter schools, across the state. Pockets of success, however, are not enough. We realize in St. Paul Public Schools that we need systemic solutions to solve deep-rooted problems around the achievement gap. And that is why I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and address one of our most critical challenges in education across this nation, which is the achievement gap. Briefly, the achievement gap is the disparity in test scores and other academic indicators between white students and students of color, as well as between students in poverty and those of higher socioeconomic status. And of course, under No Child Left Behind, we also look at English language learners and I mentioned poverty. Given how persuasive and pervasive and entrenched some of these achievement gaps are, our school district can't accomplish this work alone, nor can any district. We in St. Paul are determined to close our gaps, and to do so, we're strengthening the support and connections between schools, families, and the community. Together, we will close the achievement gap and have outlined a very strategic plan to do that. And what we do in St. Paul, we believe, can be the learning process that can be applied and used across the state of Minnesota and as an urban model for our country. The data show us, and I expect it comes as no surprise to you, that if you followed the news, St. Paul Public Schools has experienced some success in actually closing the achievement gap. In fact, we believe we're in a renaissance period of our own. There are two areas in particular where we and St. Paul Public Schools are bridging gaps. First, with our English language learner students and what we call our beating the odds schools. I'll start with English language learners. English language learner students in St. Paul are closing the achievement gap. ELL students in St. Paul Public Schools outperform their statewide peers in reading in 95% of the grade and subject comparisons. English language learners in St. Paul Public Schools outperform their state peers in mathematics in 72% of the grade and subject comparisons. A report by the Council of Great City Schools, which represents 66 of the largest urban school districts in our country, found that St. Paul had the greatest success in closing the achievement gap between English language learners and non-English language learner students. At all grade levels tested, St. Paul made greater gains closing this gap than the state and the other 65 great city school districts across the country. In 2005 and 6, ELL achievement in mathematics on the Stanford Achievement Test, a nationally normed test, exceeded the national average, and SAT-10 is no longer administered in these grades. To help achieve this success, we've dedicated more than $13 million from our general fund budget to support ELL programming. Now, individual examples, our beating the odds schools. Every year we run data in a number of different ways to identify beating the odds schools. Our identification goes beyond our state test scores. In other words, we do not depend on the MCA2s to be the only indicator of whether or not our schools in St. Paul are successful. And that does not mean we're lowering our standards. We're just trying to be more realistic about the performance and the outcomes of our schools and students. We call this process apples-to-apples comparisons of school performance. We found that our school district is seeing individual school success and closing gaps. And here are just two examples. Farnsworth Elementary School, where 77% of our students who qualify for free and reduced lunch and 52% are English language learners, the school actually outperformed the district and state peers in both reading and math on the MCA2s. Or you could take Dayton's Bluff, where 91% of the students qualify for free or reduced lunch, and a third are English language learners. On state tests in math and reading, Dayton's Bluff students scored above the district average and outperformed their matched statewide peers. And that's just two of a dozen we highlighted this past school year. When we look at our individual school successes to replicate the success system-wide, the key elements of school success we found need to be created across all of our schools, and they look like this. First, strong school leadership. Principals and creating bench strength for principals is critical to a school's success. Two, teacher quality. Building a foundation of comprehensive professional development that involves things like common planning time, job-embedded coaching models, formative assessments day-to-day. I heard the question about IEPs for every kid. That's how you get an IEP for every kid. Teachers need to know where students are every day. We do that through formative assessments. We also need a very consistent look at what teachers believe and how they interact with students. That means no more low expectations. You have to believe that every child will and can learn, and you will stop at nothing to ensure that they actually do. Third, engaged, involved caregivers. And that doesn't necessarily fall on the backs of parents, although we'd like to see that. We want to know that there's a caring adult in every child's life. There are schools that have mentoring and tutoring programs that make a huge difference. And when we do that really well, a child finds and shows that they are even more engaged in school. And finally, sustainable funding. There is nothing more frustrating and more morale-killing than to then create programs, invest in people, and then pull the rug out from underneath their feet. Without the money and resources to continue this kinds of programming, to hire the best principals and teachers, and to continue to invest in programs that work, you cannot get the job done. So, even though we have pockets of success, and I could point to other schools and programs and even groups of students where we do a really, really good job, There are still persistent achievement gaps in St. Paul Public Schools, and this is where they are. In St. Paul, white students are more than twice as likely to be proficient as black students and American Indian students, specifically black students, which include African immigrant and African American students, score 41 percentage points below white students in mathematics. The gaps persist with other ethnic groups, although not as great equally as scary. American Indian students are 35 percentage points below, and Hispanic students are 23 percentage points below. In reading, white students are twice as likely to be proficient as black students. Black students scored 41 percentage points below white students. Asian American students are 37 percentage points below. Hispanic students are 34 points below, and American Indian students are 33 points below. In reading and math, non-low-income students are twice as likely to be proficient as low-income students in reading and math, and non-special education students, regular ed kids, are more than twice as likely to be proficient as special ed students. Low-income special ed white students are outperforming low-income non-special ed black students in math in most grade levels. So let me repeat that. That means that poor white students in special ed outperform poor regular education black students. In spite of our efforts to reduce dropout rates, we have a disparity with our graduation rates as well. Only 51% of American Indian students, 60% of Latino students, and 74% of black students actually graduated from St. Paul Public Schools in 2006. Low-income, non-ELL black students are also likely to underperform their statewide peers on the MCA2s. So you might ask yourself, given all of this data, what is St. Paul Public Schools doing to close the achievement gap? First, and I'm in my just finished my first year as the superintendent, we did complete in my first year early a comprehensive 5-year strategic plan, and this is the backbone for which we are structuring all of our work. The plan was developed with extensive community input, and we have clear goals with benchmarks for every year. And I have provided copies of the strategic plan and the implementation guide that painstakingly outlines the benchmarks and targets for every area of the 9 subgroups under No Child Left Behind. Ensuring high academic achievement for all students, raising expectations for accountability, accelerating the path to excellence, aligning resource allocation to district priorities, and strengthening relationships with community and families are the key goals of our strategic plan to deliver on a premier education for all. Of course, we have actually passed a referendum targeting referendum resources to our bookends in education, which are early childhood education and then preparing kids for life after graduation with secondary education are the ways that we talk about our referendum in St. Paul. Last year, and bless them, St. Paul voters approved a 6-year levy, and as promised, we are targeting much of those funds to preventing the achievement gaps. Schools prevent achievement gaps by giving students a strong start. Investing in the bookends of education is the cornerstone of this work. We've invested a portion of our referendum to support 4-year-old programs and all-day kindergarten at all of our schools. $3.8 million for 4-year-old programs, $2 million for all-day kindergarten, where more than 1,100 students in programs for 4-year-old students and 800 students are still on our waiting list. On the other end of the K-12 spectrum, our levy provides resources to provide and prepare our students for life after graduation, careers, and post-secondary education. We are not embarrassed in St. Paul Public Schools to write in our strategic plan that we do expect kids to go to college. We are putting $4.2 million into our high schools with a focus on math and science, one of the greatest gatekeepers for kids being successful in college. We want to increase the number of students taking college prep and AP courses through programs like Avid, and to get more students planning for college by taking pre-college tests like PLAN, PSAT, ACT, and SAT. We cannot wait until the 11th grade to talk about college. For families that don't have a history for sending their kids to college, need to be talking about it earlier to prepare for that. This year, we're targeting absences and attendance. Of course, we can't teach them if they aren't in school. Research into closing the achievement gap consistently points to the importance of high-quality teaching staff. To this end, we're focusing on staff development, as I said before, with a job-embedded coaching model. This means we're not taking teachers out of the school or out of the classroom for training. That has negative effects, less classroom time or less contact time with students, and certainly that means that they're not getting real-time feedback while they're working with kids. It's a proven method that is not only effective but efficient, and we are really investing a lot of resources there. Data and best practices are key. Every step of the way, we use research to best guide our decisions. As I mentioned earlier, the use of data is critical for how we use our resources, and if we're going to change the bureaucracy in which we live, it is very important that people, we found, want to know the reasons why we are changing our practice. And finally, community development. We are very serious about reestablishing our partnerships. We've received a planning grant to work specifically with our African and Black communities on the achievement gap between white and Black students. This is our most persistent achievement gap, so it's the first one we're tackling, but it won't be the last. This work will serve as the framework for what we do in all areas of our achievement gap across St. Paul. And I'll close by giving you a highlight for where we think we need greater state support. I have talked about a comprehensive staff development model, raising teacher quality, enhancing school leadership. This is one area where we feel like once you invest in people who want to lead schools and want to lead schools in an urban setting, you have not made a more important investment. We want to see more funding for early childhood education and all-day kindergarten. Art Rolnick of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve Bank has calculated there's a 16% inflation-adjusted return on investment of high-quality early childhood education for at-risk children. Investing in kids when they're young, and it is much less likely, as you can see by the math, to cost you in the long term. And high school reform initiatives. Through our referendum, we are putting money in our high schools to focus on math and science. The governor has made high school education one of his top concerns. And of course, we share the focus and want to prepare kids for science, technology, math, and engineering, and we're committing the resources to do it. But preparing kids for a high-tech, global, rapidly evolving economy is expensive. Business in these fields invest millions of dollars this year, and the reason they do that is because they know there's a big payoff. We want to see our kids graduate with lucrative jobs and the ability to make decisions as an informed citizen in a democracy. And fully funding mandates this year, I'd like to congratulate the legislature on taking a great step forward on funding special education. And given that we still have about a $14 million cross-subsidy of K-12 funds into special education, one of the initiatives from our strategic plan is to reduce the numbers of students identified for certain special ed services. The current state formula has no incentive. In fact, the district's revenue is reduced for cutting special ed referrals. The alternative special ed changes are helpful, but the current local effort to provide 50% of the new funding will make it virtually impossible when we're looking at a 1% increase in the general ed formula for next year. So, in conclusion, we are committed to closing the achievement gaps, and in Minnesota, we are top in the nation for national education rankings. If any state knows how to teach, it's this one. If we can close the achievement gap anywhere, it's gonna be Minnesota. And if I have my say, it will start in St. Paul Public Schools. Thank you for your interest in this issue and for your commitment for the children of Minnesota.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
Such a powerful message and eloquent. We're very proud that you are doing all of this work in St. Paul, and all of us are talking about it. I want you to know
Good.
That every person who's come to our offices say you really need to pay attention to what is happening in St. Paul. So I really congratulate you for the work that you're doing. Any questions?
Senator Wigger? Thank you, Madam Chair and Superintendent. I think you highlighted four areas that would be key to making progress: effective principals, outstanding teachers, empowered parents, and resources. Explore empowered parents. What needs to be done to get more people meaningfully engaged in their child's education? Because it probably is the number one determinant, and you can tell me if that's still the case. what is the district doing, and what if a parent chooses not to be involved? Any suggestions? But take us down that road more.
Right. Clarity on a little bit of the research. The number one determinant for a child's success, academic success, is actually the classroom teacher. Research shows that the highest quality teacher you can put in a classroom will get you the greatest result in academic achievement, which is why any day, if I have to hang my hat on something, it's going to be teacher quality, closely followed by principal leadership. Now, I would say the third, running for the top three always, is definitely this issue about parent involvement and support. Now, I don't know about all the other districts in the state of Minnesota, but in St. Paul Public Schools, we really don't get the pleasure of having a very stable parental environment for many of our kids. They come, some of our kids are undocumented, or I should say many of our kids are undocumented. Often they come to us with in families, but not really the parents. We also find that because of some of the needs of our children, they're in our juvenile justice system or even in our care facilities in the state. But we do know that having, and this is why I carefully said it before, having a caring adult with a child, so what we can do around mentoring and support, having teachers be engaged with the student, goes a long way for filling that gap with parents, but it does not supplant it, you know. So to engage, and I'm going to say caregivers, because they grandparents serve and older siblings serve, and we see a lot of stuff come through St. Paul Public Schools, that the most important thing we found from our parents is that they feel welcomed and respected in our schools. There's no faster way to turn off our parents is when there is a cultural disrespect and when there is not an avenue for them to have ways to connect with the staff of the school. So what we are trying to change in our practice, and we've done a really good job of it, but we still have a long way to go, is be much more sensitive. Simple things like translating the documents that we send to families. When we send our school choice program, it's translated in four different languages. We provide at our school level sometimes, not all schools can afford them, but language liaisons, people who can actually, you know, if it's a school where there's a large population of Somali students, we want to have a coordinator there who can actually speak Somali and engage with our parents. We also do outreach, or try to do outreach, where we've encouraged our principals to do more. Go to the home. Don't wait for the parents to come to you. I think that parents or caregivers are very often willing to meet us halfway when we make simple steps toward understanding that they don't all come from the same demographic or socioeconomic background. We also have done some other things that I think makes a difference in St. Paul, like around choice, giving families, especially around transportation, when they don't really have the resources to do that, to provide more choice through transportation and allow them to pick schools and programs that match their child's need, that isn't determinant, doesn't get determined by their zip code or where they bought their home in the city of St. Paul. So there's a lot of things that we do that just make their lives more connected to the school experience. But by and large, I think that it comes down to having parents understand that when they do come to us, that we welcome them and that we engage them, and that where they tell us that they have trouble making it to a school or being able to participate in our events, that we do simple things like change the time or the day that we do conferences, or even like I said, go to the home and meet with the parents. So it's some of those things, and then we do much more systemic things like aggressively recruit for our site councils and try to have more diversity on our site councils to bring in parents and families that are traditionally disenfranchised. And depending on which school it is, because some of our schools are neighborhood schools, some are year-round, some are, I could just go through a bunch of them, we have a lot of stuff to pick from in St. Paul. Depending on the school, that's where leadership matters. We really depend on that principal to know its student body and to really do the outreach from what we've learned about our demographics. But that's a little bit of what we do. We're not there. And our families have participated with us in our strategic planning process and have given us a lot of strategies for what they think would work for them, often driven by their cultural, the cultural dynamics of their lifestyle.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are going to be reviewing this information in depth. And thank you for providing those reports to us. Unfortunately, we run out of time, but we have one more quick question.
Sure.
If we could please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Last year, we've heard a lot of discussion on integration funding. And I just want to get a little bit of perspective on what you think about the integration funding for the St. Paul School District. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it's important. In fact, I'll let you know now that I subcommittee chair, and we're going to be doing a integration hearing coming up soon. But I just want to hear your perspective on what you think about the integration funding.
I think the funding's great. So I want to go on the record that we really need the integration funding. We do participate with EMID, the East Metro Integration District Consortium. We went through so many scenarios this year in trying to be more fair and equitable with our partners on, you know, what these resources look like and how we work them. But, and as a matter of fact, I just had lunch with people today, and we were talking about all of the the new conversation about race, integration, segregation. I mean, we could just go on that there's this whole new conversation. And what I would say is that we're not there yet as a country, and we certainly aren't there yet as school districts in Minnesota and even in St. Paul. The funding is, I'd like to think that we have been I wish we had more to point to say that the integration funding has worked really well. I mean, that's one thing that I think as evidence for, what No Child Left Behind asked for around student achievement would be important to understand how that has made a difference. Of course, that wasn't the standard at the time. It was more about, how do we bring sort of culture and people together to be able to work and go to school together. What I don't have research on yet either, and I suspect that it'll be quite challenging, is when, if you see the movement of charter schools right now, a lot of schools are going to culturally specific types of programs, which in my mind sort of defeats the purpose of integration. We're kind of going back to a much more segregated model. So, I've had my head in special ed for so long, but I am starting to come out to look in integration, and I have to say that, I think that it's a worthy conversation to have, because the purpose for integration at the beginning was solid and still is today, because I don't see where schools have quite gotten their arms around what it means to create an educational environment that naturally creates racial, ethnic, and experiential diversity in our schools. And if you need that kind of funding to hold that, the spirit of that, alive in a school, I think that is a worthy investment. Does it today, though, really move us off the dime around achievement? I don't think we've studied it that way. I just don't, I don't think anybody's looked at it that way. And that might be the lift that we need to re-energize this conversation. And I think the findings of that would be not only informative, but would help guide us to make better decisions about the use of those dollars.
Really have to move.
Thank you so much. I'm sitting here
pontificating. I have to interrupt, but
yes,
we have about 45 minutes
to
finish
on that.
So thank you for Thank you for your presentation. Yep. Thank you for all your work. And we definitely will continue this conversation with you. So thank you for being here. Next, we have Dr. Green from the Minneapolis Public Schools. Welcome, Dr. Green. We're very happy that you're here.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself and start your presentation.
My name is Bill Green, Superintendent of Schools, Minneapolis. I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak with you within a couple minutes. I'm real fascinated with the last question, and I'd like to try to get through some of this, and if possible, if there's time left, perhaps pick up our discussion on that question. Once again, I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak, and because I tend to feel more comfortable standing behind a microphone and sort of speaking off the cuff, I am in an awkward position because I'm stuck behind this microphone and with notes. So I'm going to stick close to the notes so I can get through the stuff. Otherwise, my lobbyist is going to go nuts on me, and he wants me to make these various points. Our data has been distributed to you, and I'll give you a chance to look at that on your time. I'm here to talk about, as you'd like for me to do, about the gaps which exist between race and class, ELL status, and special education students classified in special education. That's what the gaps reflect in the data that you have. The obvious question is, why do those gaps exist? And it's especially important question in light of the fact that Minneapolis has some of the best educators in the state. There are many reasons that contribute to the gap, to the various gaps, one of which is that many of the reasons are non-educational, and I want to come back to that. Well, I'll speak specifically about something appeared in today's paper with yet another murder of our children. The fact of the matter is an increasing number of our children, live lives that deny them of their own innocence. And to the extent that our various partners can work more effectively with schools to secure and protect the lives of our children, I think is one major way of diminishing the gap, namely letting kids know that society views and values their lives and views them as being capable of achieving. But Minneapolis Public Schools has a responsibility, a major responsibility. This is the reason why we exist, to educate kids. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that we are doing to meet up to our responsibility. There are basically four key reasons or key elements to what we're doing in Minneapolis Public Schools. The first thing is enhancing rigor for all kids. And what that includes is the belief, the truly heartfelt belief among all of our educators that every kid can learn. We need to raise expectations, and that has to be expressed and fully felt in every classroom. The second key thing is a strategic integration of initiatives, what we call the FIT. Minneapolis has been faced, as most public institutions, with many initiatives that have come down the pike in the last several years. And like many institutions, Minneapolis has oftentimes gone wherever the dollars were, which means that you lose focus. What we are doing now is selecting initiatives that fit together in a cohesive and strategic way, which means that there are times when we must actually say no to good ideas, but ideas that divert us from our focus. The third key point is to hold everything and everyone accountable. And that is, that's fairly clear what we mean by that, but that also includes the necessity in viewing people as a resource. The accountability measures are not just meant to be punitive, but principally viewed in a way of helping everyone know how to be better. And also, in every kind of initiative that we embrace, that we actually take time to figure out what it is we want that initiative to perform and to measure that success or the level of performance at the end of its program, and that becomes a determination of whether we continue the partnership with that. The fourth key thing is to stay focused on the instructional core. This is what Minneapolis Public Schools, as I said before, has to be about. And everything we do has to be about advancing the instructional core. We have basically looked at the program of Minneapolis Public Schools as being not just K-12, but pre-K-12. And I just want to talk about the first stage, pre-K to 3. Our goal is to have every child arriving in kindergarten ready to learn and to have every third grader ready to read. Some of the strategies that we're employing is supporting the programs that we already have in place and partner with community early childhood programs, also establishing literary coaches in every elementary school for professional development, coaches who will provide observation, intervention, and assessment of the teaching methods of our teachers, all-day kindergarten, high five, early reading first, and extend child care to invisible populations, invisible meaning populations that have not historically been have participated with some of the early childhood programming that we've done. We want to make a much more aggressive, take a much more aggressive effort to reach out to those communities. I've also added in the strategies looking at our whole program as a way of supporting the pathways. That is to say that the programs of rigor will begin in elementary school and not just in high school, so that it is possible for kids, regardless of their race or ethnicity or residency in the community, have access, for example, to IB, International Baccalaureate or Advanced Placement, and that they can begin that preparation in grade one. We have programs set up throughout our school system in which children in those advanced placement type programs can stay in the programming from first grade right up to high school. In dealing specifically with the achievement gap, the district is committed to aggressive recruitment of kids of color and kids of various socioeconomic classes to participate in those programs from grade one. So we're not just having the programs available to people and passively allowing kids to drop out for whatever reason. We are committed to aggressively keeping kids in the program, all kids, and nurturing their development throughout the entire process. And we can talk more about that if there's more time. Grades 4 through 8. Well, we're building on what has been established or what we're trying to establish from pre-K to 3. By adding in 4th through 8th grades mastery in reading to deepen content mastery, algebra for all kids by grade 8, view middle grades as an entry to high school, introduce My Life Plan. There are other initiatives as well, but these are just some of the examples we're talking about. The third point that I refer to, viewing middle grades as entry to high school, this is all part of viewing the grade levels as part of a continuum rather than separated. Too oftentimes we talk about middle grades kids as a separate category and that middle grades curriculum is a separate entity. We have to, and we are developing a curriculum and providing resources. It's reflected in our budget of looking at middle grades as an entry for high school. My Life Plan, as I mentioned before, is a computer-based program that has kids begin to ask themselves in a much more concerted way, what do you want to do? What do you want to be? This is in collaboration with resources that we've invested for school counselors. But we find that many of our children don't really think about their futures in a very realistic or at all, for all intents and purposes. And this is our deliberate intent to, first of all, remind children that they do have a future and that this is the time to begin to think about that future, especially in advent to structuring coursework that will help them position themselves best for graduation. High school reform. I hope that at some point in the future you will again invite my team, Chief Academic Officer Bernadia Johnson and Associate Superintendent Brenda Casilius, to present to you our ideas for high school reform, which is really secondary reform. It's a program, or really an initiative, that integrates grades 6 through 12. It looks at the configuration of schools that we're looking at, the various programming that will be offered to in all of the programs, in all of the schools. There are all sorts of very exciting ideas that we think can advance the whole initiative of high school reform. It will take more time than I have here to explain it to you, but I hope that we can come back and make that presentation to you. These are ideas that we're taking around to all of our stakeholders. We're giving parents and high school teachers and all of the other stakeholders an opportunity to see this idea and to participate in the development of it. And this is another way in which we hope can inadvertently deal with closing the achievement gap, namely engaging the entire community in the education process of kids. High school reform, post-secondary transition. Just to follow my notes again, high school must prepare students for post-secondary without need of remediation. Our graduation rate was impressive this year. Our numbers went up, but the fact of the matter remains that graduation rates mean little if graduates have to rely on remediation once they get into college or tech school or wherever. If they need to go through remediation, then we have not succeeded in our preparation. So our curriculum is geared towards preparing kids for post-secondary education without the need for remediation. Some of our strategies, AP opportunities for all kids, reform that engages students and gives them ownership of learning, create higher quality programs and career technical education programs, which have shown successful, for they have indicated that kids involved in those programs been able to close the gaps, show retention, attendance is higher, the MCA tests indicate gains, and higher graduation. College career centers help with college applications and career research help, online help. All of this is geared towards, at least with regard to the high school piece, is geared towards telling young people that a future can be theirs. It is accessible, and we'll show you how to position yourself to take best advantage of what we have so that you can have some control over your life, have some full claim over your life. Coupled with these initiatives, these curricular initiatives, professional development, teacher development, for example, QComp and MNTAP are key strategies, especially for our MCLB Level 3, 4, and 5 schools in need of improvement and restructuring, as well as Institute of Learning, IFL, which is a professional development initiative out of the University of Pittsburgh for principal and teacher development. It's effort-based learning. It deals with the principles that all students with effort can learn. That's the key phrase here, with effort. All students with effort can learn. This means that we are telling kids that, you know, you can learn if you put emphasis, if you put effort into the process itself. Job and embedded professional development for teachers and principals. Principals and teachers go on school walks as an effort to kind of see how teachers are doing and to offer ways to enhance or improve the way that instruction is performed in the classroom, and also to solidify team relationship between principals and teachers, minimize the adversarial relationship that so often exists in our schools between teachers and principals. We also have initiated positive behavior intervention strategies. This is in an effort to address the issue of behavior and to reduce suspensions. Kids can't learn if they're not in the classroom. Kids can't learn if they're not in a learning environment. And kids can't learn if they are penalized after an action has occurred. PBIS, Positive Behavior Intervention Strategies, is a proactive approach to behavior issues, teaching behavior expectations directly, and the results lead to more time learning, less time management behavior, reduce suspensions, and students feel safe and welcoming. And this is all the initiatives that we're doing is based on best practices. It's not stuff that is that just comes out of people's imaginations. It has a legacy. We're not experimenting with any of these initiatives. The Northside initiative, I think, reflects the district's commitment to addressing the achievement gap and enhancing the quality of learning for all kids. On the north side of Minneapolis, that's the northwest quadrant of the city, we have the steepest decline in enrollment, the broadest achievement gap, and it also is the poorest section, the section that has the most challenges, non-educational as well as educational challenges. And we had buildings up there that were only half-filled, and we were using our resources to keep half-filled buildings in operation. So what we did was to consolidate those programs so that we can create more services and support for kids. We don't include in the documents that you have any sort of information on the Northside Initiative. We can send that over to you. But we have a host of offerings and support, which includes class size limitations and daycare for families. The principals who were selected to preside over the schools on the north side were principals who wanted to be there and who were very adept at reaching out to the community and forming community relationships. An example of that is a partnership existing between Minneapolis Public Schools and the Northside Schools in particular and communities of faith. In fact, we had our first meeting with the leaders of those communities of faith and the schools last week, introductory. And we're not afraid to fresh start when we need to. Fresh start basically means that we are able to hire teachers who want to be in the schools. This is a controversial method because we prefer to partner with the teachers' union, and we are working very, very hard to work with the teachers in a joint value of having a system that allows teachers to be selected who can make the best fit for the school itself, who want to be in a particular school, and who are best qualified to teach in the school. One of the things that I have not mentioned directly, that we must mention directly, since we're talking about the achievement gap, is the issue of race. We are working on efforts to address the issue of cultural competency. And this is a difficult issue to address, not just because people feel uncomfortable talking about race, and frankly, I feel people are less uncomfortable than we give them credit for being. What is difficult about addressing how we talk about race within the context of Minneapolis Public Schools and education, I think, is that we're not sure what we want those discussions to provide. There is the presumption that discussions about race and institutional racism and personally held biases and prejudices are important in and of themselves, and to some extent they are important. But for purposes of educating kids, they must be focused to enhancing education, to advancing the learning process. And to the extent that the cultural and racial discussions are just based on personal emotional inventories, is the extent to which we will never really get to the heart of what is needed for our children. How can we overcome institutional racism? And this becomes the essence of what our cultural competency piece is about, which is one reason why I'm interested, if time permits, and I see that it doesn't, to talk about integration. Globally, legislative. There are several entities that have to play a role in this. We are going to do our share. We're committed to that, and I'm only skimming the surface. We have other things that are connected with closing the gap. But the legislature has a responsibility as well. One thing that we would ask you to do is to consider how school funding, school financing can be brought into the 21st century and can be structured in such a way as to encourage school districts to be creative in educating children, creating incentives for experimentation, and considering other ways in which school districts are tested. I know that all of you are aware of the discussion that has begun since the last MCA results have come out. Minneapolis Public Schools embraces the need for accountability and testing and things of this nature. But when you have on one hand the achievement of Minnesota children doing well in the ACTs, for example, with accredited test, and not as well in MCAs, then, you know, something is amiss here. We need to stabilize the type of testing that we have and to hold to certain rules from year to year. But that's probably set for another discussion for another time. If we're going to have a way of looking at evaluation, let's stick with that way. Let's not move it around. Let's not move the bar up and down. Minneapolis, the city, also has a role to play in reducing the achievement gap. One of it is, and the most important way, is to support and protect its children. This brings me back to my original point. I don't want you to forget what happened to one of our kids this weekend. That's a common theme in Minneapolis schools. The first 3 days that I was on the job as superintendent, I attended two funerals, and a third young man was killed within a block of the schools. We have to find a way as a community to give more value to the lives of our children, because that's going to be the most important incentive that they can have to really put forth the effort that we need them to put forth. Thank you. I look forward to working with you more.
Thank you so much, Dr. Green. We really appreciate all the work that you're doing in Minneapolis. I'm fully aware of the challenges and the incredible work that you and your staff are doing right now. This is certainly the beginning of this conversation. So we are attempting to open the door to this conversation right now and to briefly inform the community about your efforts. But certainly this is just the beginning, so we really appreciate that. I would like to welcome Senator Carlson is here today. Welcome to the committee, Senator. And we are running out of time, unfortunately, but we have room for one question from the committee if you have a question for Dr. Green.
Well, if I may, I'd like to pose the same question. The challenge
of integration policy?
Budget integration. Dr.
I have
Green, if you could
I have Mr.
Answer.
Grathwall's watch here, so I'll keep it to just a couple minutes. And thank you very much for that question. I see my friend Myron Orfield, and he is a very important player in the discussion of this whole thing. One of the things that we need to do is to look at how we relate to the metropolitan area. Our boundaries are porous. Our kids move from district to district. And we have initiated discussions with educators in the West Metro area as to how to bring the West Metro Education Project into the 21st century. We also have to be much more proactive in how we educate our increasing numbers of students who fall into the ELL category. We have many children who are coming to the school system who don't speak English. A large number of English-speaking kids go home to families who don't speak English, and the school district has to be very aggressive and proactive in finding ways to engage that entire community. We have to be flexible with the definitions, just expanding on the on immigrant families, ELL families, not the same, one and the same. We have to be able to discern the complexities of the various communities that we have. We can't assume that one jacket fits all families. I'll give you an example of that. On the north side, the Hmong population is increasingly showing two separate communities, Hmong Thai and Laotian Hmong. And the expectations of either group are not one and the same necessarily. The Latino population in Minneapolis is growing faster than any other group, and yet to characterize the Latino population as one population is doing a disservice not just to the families but to the children. How do our schools address those needs? What does bilingual education mean, for example? And do we have adequate funding that encourages us to develop that in an effective way? Minneapolis schools is not like it was 10 years ago or 5 years ago or whenever. It's a very different school system, and the way that the school system is financed is somewhat, I won't say outdated, but it's not quite up to where we are in our rapid changes. And so to the extent that we are able to come together as a group, and I would imagine that some of the challenges that we're facing in Minneapolis are similar to a growing number of school districts as well. This is no longer an issue of Minneapolis versus the metro area and the metro area versus the rural area. This is an issue that confronts every school, so every school district to varying extents. So it's having a conversation with all of us at the table and no longer continuing a process that sets educators against educators.
Thank you so much, Dr. Green.
Thank you. Thank you.
Next we have Jay Hagen from Superintendent of West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Egan Public Schools. Thank you for being here. And I see my friends from Head Start leaving, and before they go, I want to say that it is very clear to us that early childhood education is going to be a very important component of what we do here. So I see many, many members of Early Childhood, Ready for K is here, Head Start is here, ECFE. We have a number of people who have come to hear this, and we will be talking about early childhood education during these hearings and trying to connect also with the initiatives that are chaired by Senator Terry Bonoff that has the Early Childhood Committee and Senator Saltzman that has the Early Literacy Committee. So those the three of us are trying to figure out how do we put this component together. So thank you for being here. Thank you and welcome.
Well, thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for having me. My name is Jay Haugen. I'm currently the superintendent of West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Egan. I'm actually in my 12th year as superintendent in Minnesota. For 10 years, I was in the wonderful community of Sleepy Eye. And I was there at superintendent during the years where Sleepy Eye went from a rural German community, just a very small minority population, to a school district that had one of the highest Latino populations in the state, if not the highest. It happened at a time that us as a community and a school welcomed that diversity, saw it as a strength, saw it as economic development, if nothing else, for our communities. It was a wonderful time. And I happened to see my high school principal. I didn't know she was going to be here, Elia Bruggeman. So if you want to get the full story and all of that, and all the during that time we had over 50 partners that we developed over those 10 years that helped us welcome and support that population. That's one small school, a K-12 school of 700 students. Kind of gives you the idea of the magnitude of really supporting a new population, a population that that needs to achieve. Currently now, I'm in my second year, again, as superintendent in West St. Paul, Mendota Heights, Egan. Our population's changing, too. 5 years ago, our school district had 1 in 5 students who was a minority student. It had about 14% poverty. Just 5 years later, we have One in three of our students now is a minority student, and we have well over 30% poverty. And that's a change that's happening rapidly and is certainly going to continue in the future. So this is, kind of as Dr. Green said, a very important issue for us. I also can really shorten my comments here because of some of the excellent comments and by both superintendents, both of my colleagues. But also it really occurred to me that our issues, that our underachievement, that our successes and unsuccesses are really the same. And being a superintendent of 12 years, looking at all the schools I've gotten to know and all the superintendents I've gotten to know, they really are the same. So this is a systemic issue. I'm so excited to be here and that this is an issue that you are taking up because it is not, it is more than one school district or one classroom. It is something that our state has to really, really get behind as a whole body. I have this dream like they have. I have this dream like every superintendent of coming to that point where we break once and for all the cycle of underachievement, which then begets the cycle of poverty. And we all have that dream. And so there must be some systemic thing that's stopping us from getting there. Whenever I talk about schools and school achievement, I have to put that in context of what I ask of my schools. I expect to have schools that are without holes. And so when you look at a hole like the achievement gap, you know, that's something that just doesn't fit in my heart of what I want for my schools. Something has to be done. But I also want schools where every student has an opportunity to find greatness. Greatness is often found for a student, you know, in a lot of those other programs, whether it's mock trial or debate or might be on the athletic field or in music or playing in the orchestra. Because once you've been part of something great, you hunger for it, and you want to be part of something great throughout your life. And I think that's a big part of being successful. And so the third thing that I ask of my schools is that we spend as much time working on our students' strengths as their weaknesses. Sometimes we can get so focused on finding out what kids aren't good at and then making them do it over and over again, we forget that we all of us, find our success in those things we have a passion for, things that come natural to us, and everyone has that. And we need to make sure that our schools also focus on those things. I actually learned a little something about the achievement gap driving here today. I stopped at one of my schools, a middle school, 5-8 middle school, Heritage Middle School in West St. Paul. And outside the front was this huge semi. It says Christina Smiles on the outside. And it's a group that comes around. They go to 20 different cities every year in the United States and provide free dental care. They only come and do that if you step forward with all the supplies. So Patterson Dental gave up all the supplies, and volunteers of all the dentists and all the workers need to staff that. And they will run 40 students who otherwise wouldn't get dental care a day through that. This morning, the little bit of time I stopped there, I saw a sixth grade girl who had been in pain for a month with a tooth. And, you know, no way with her family to get that fixed. It turned out it was two teeth, and through this operation, they had them filled and her ready to go in 45 minutes, and that's going to change her achievement. There was another student that, while he didn't talk about pain, about a fourth or fifth grade boy, they extracted three of his teeth. They were in such bad shape. And there was a girl that had a terrible spot on her tooth, on her front tooth. She wouldn't smile. She was like a second or third grader, but she wouldn't smile because everyone she thought was looking at that spot on her tooth. They got rid of that spot, and she smiled and she cried. So there are many facets of closing the achievement gap, and I'm actually here just to talk to you about one specific one. Our school district has this fabulous program. It's called ALMAS, and ALMAS, A-L-M-A-S, it really stands for Anglos and Latinos Motivated to Succeed. It was started by a Spanish teacher about in our school district, Senior Hansen, about, well, I think it was about 6 years ago. No. At the time, he recognized what we all recognize, is that a high number of our Latino students and a growing population of them were not finding success. Over 40% of them in our school, as happens in many, many schools, didn't even graduate. And so he understood that the first thing to do, you can't help them if they're not there. They have to graduate. And he started a program with the goal of having 100% of the Latino students in our high school, Henry Sibley High School, part of this program, where they were together as a family in school. They supported each other. They learned together how important education was and how it was the gateway to a successful life. But they also provided service as a group. They went and put together these wonderful positive messages, and they used music, and they used dance, and they put things on video, and they did their own words, and they got themselves costumes and equipment. And so now they go out to other schools and organizations and help them understand the importance of school and not smoking and all the wonderful messages that they have. And so today, with that group, we've gone from over 40% dropout rate to under 10%. Nearly 100% of the Latino students in our school, well over 150, are involved in this program. And it's just one way. It's not something to be duplicated. It's not so that every school starts an almost program, but to understand that, you know, that's certainly a piece of it, is having all students be successful. Having all students be successful is having them all there. And it takes a large effort, and it takes tying students and engaging students to the life of school, and they worked with their families as well. But this is a resource-extensive, you can probably tell, program. It's a very difficult to keep the resources. The school district commits its own resources to this every year. We've had partners of 3M. We've had partners with Dakota County. We're looking to get another partner with General Mills to keep this program going. But that's not the kind of thing that solves every problem everywhere across the state. We need stable funding for programs like that. And I can tell you just a little bit about that in my final comment is we, as a school district, are facing a levy that has been part of our basic funding for over 7 years. It provides 9% of our funding. If it's not voted in November, it goes away. And they would, at that point, it would become a choice between, do we have 40 to 45 students in an Algebra 1 class, or do we continue to fund ALMUS, a wildly successful program? And so there are some choices that ahead of us that are very, very difficult. And the final thing about funding, because there are some good funds, Minnesota actually has stepped forward and given funds for a variety of students who for like students of poverty and students who have English as a second language. But we also have very good information on how much it really takes. We have good information that it takes for a student of poverty 75% more to have them achieve at the level of the rest of the students. We have good information that it takes nearly 90% more for an English as a second language student to achieve with the rest of the population. And so, you know, I think that kind of brings up the magnitude when we talk about resources. To break the cycle of poverty and underachievement once and for all. So I thank you again, and I'm very happy to take some questions.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the information. And clearly, when we look at who did we need to hear from first, clearly your efforts and the work that you were doing in the different schools in your district became to the top of the list. So that's when we look at the statistics today, the alarming statistics in the state of Minnesota, and we look at these three districts and the huge number of children of color you have, the increased number, the change in demographics, and the huge percentage of free and reduced lunch children. We clearly see that the challenges you have ahead of you are huge, and we need to figure out how do we support your efforts from the state. Any questions from members? Senator Salzman.
Yes. And thank you, Madam Chair. I liked your comments as you spoke about the achievement gap, But I always like to kind of rephrase that, is that we have an achievement gap because we have an opportunity gap. And what you're doing is trying to find the opportunities for, you know, many of these children and students who are falling behind. And so I think that that's the way I kind of tend to look at this is, you know, we look at the problem, and it, to me, the, like, you know, solutions are in the opportunities. And I just wanted to note that we also have someone here today, Superintendent Romaine Dalamond, who is from Rochester, a new superintendent to Minnesota. But we met and talked about the same topic and the commitment of the superintendents are in our state to address this. I am just very, very, just so happy to hear that, you know, it's not seen as something that we can't overcome if we continue to work together and really identify the programs that work. And I think that's what this committee is looking at. And I just commend, you know, our chairs for the work that they've done already to look at the programs that are working, because I think that's where we start to find those things that we need to support and find out why we're not doing more of them. So you've identified one of the barriers, but do you find that there is a lot of students who are coming and going from your district? Because that's another thing that I think is a challenge, is students that we have great programs, but if students aren't staying in them, we can't keep them in the same school. Is that an issue?
Well, that's certainly that is certainly an issue, and that's really part of why we have things like Almus, where you immediately get them into school, because so often it seems that when things then start going sour for them, right away a new student will start looking for, a student who hasn't found much success will make a choice to find another school, and then other hurdles to get over. And so if we can get them engaged in the life of school and keep them. If I was go back briefly to Sleepy Eye, that's part of what we did. We found out we had so many programs, summer programs and after-school programs and things during the day, that the families would actually just come settle. They found a place. They felt supported, and they became part of the community. And migrant students became immigrant students, became, you know, part of our community. And right now in Sleepy Eye, I know there's two Latino members of the school board, which is just a kind of a whole other step for our community to have taken.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
I will now like to welcome Mr. Myron Orfield. I had really the great privilege to hear Mr. Orfield's presentation in private and was so impressed, but at the same time very saddened to learn these patterns of segregation that exist within our state, and very saddened to learn about the situation of many, many kids and many families that live in segregated communities and the high concentration of poverty that exists within some of these communities. And certainly, as I learned from his research, I quickly went into different websites and found numerous papers that really talk about this issue. So this is an issue that has been well researched, and it's a compelling issue, and I'm glad that many people are here to listen to his presentation. I know that he did a presentation at the Humphrey Institute, and many of you were there. This is something that I am interested in learning more about, and I would like to hear from people after this meeting, because certainly the Councils of Color who came and the American Indian Council who came to talk to me about the need to really focus our attention in child poverty really talk extensively about housing. So welcome, Mr. Orfield, and please introduce yourself and start your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Myron Orfield. I am an associate professor of law and director of the Institute on Race and Poverty at the University of Minnesota Law School. I'm going to talk today about another part of the achievement gap, growing racial and social segregation in the schools of the metropolitan area. There are two pieces to the achievement gap. There's an inside piece, an inside game, if you will, about what schools and administrators and school districts can do to try to deal with the growing social inequality within the school site. But there's also an underlying reality of social and racial segregation, which are joined at the hip. Black and Latino children in this metropolitan area and in the United States are far more likely to go to schools that are high poverty. About three-quarters of poor Black and Latino children in this metropolitan area and throughout the country go to schools that are more than 70% poor children. For white children, that percentage is about a third. In this metropolitan area, in the last 10 years, we've really caught up with the rest of the country in terms of these issues of social and racial segregation in the schools. So we're dealing not only with the inequality that children bring with them to the schools from their family and their background and economic differences, but the very different schools that are emerging, schools that are defined by race and class, schools that are overwhelmingly poor in many places of the city and the older suburbs, where that poverty, the concentration of poverty in schools, dramatically depresses graduation rates, college attendance, and the likelihood that children will have jobs in middle-income settings. It also is strongly related to test scores, but particularly in terms of these achievement gaps, in terms of high school graduation going on to college and good middle-income jobs, kids that go to racially and socially segregated schools have an increasing achievement gap. That's a very big part of the achievement gap, and it's a part of the achievement gap that's growing as our schools become more and more socially and racially isolated. I'm going to talk a little bit briefly about the about what's going on in the Twin Cities, and I'll reference a report that the Institute on Race and Poverty did on its website called "The Choice Is Ours: Expanding Educational Opportunity for All Children." I also would like to reference work that the Institute is doing with a number of partners: the Urban League of African American Family Services, HACER, and Central Campesino. We've been looking at the outside levels and the broad statistical data. They've been thinking about what's happening inside the schools and inside racially diverse communities. In 1992, there were only nine non-white segregated schools in the metropolitan area, about 2% of all schools. By 2002, the number of non-white segregated schools had jumped to 109, nearly 20% of all schools, very rapid increase. The share of students of color attending non-white segregated schools increased more than fivefold, from 9% in 1992 to 46% in 2002. The number of students of color attending non-white segregated schools in the Twin Cities skyrocketed from 2,832 in 1992 to 29,000, almost 30,000 in 2002. The share of African American students in non-white segregated schools more than tripled, from 14% in 1992 to 50% in 2002. This meant that 14,500 Black elementary students attended segregated schools in 2002, up from 1,981 in 1992. The share of Latinos and Asian students attending non-white segregated schools increased even more dramatically from 1992 to 2002, from 3% to 39% for Latinos and from 1% to 45% for Asian Americans. During this period, the number of Latino elementary school students in segregated schools went from 81 to 5,122, and the number in Asian elementary schools increased from 141 to about 8,800, almost 8,900. From 1992, the school poverty rate faced by the typical non-white student increased from about 40 to 44%, although, as you're going to see, in the core cities and the older suburbs, this increased much more dramatically, while the typical poverty rate faced by the typical white student declined from 14 to 13%. The share of non-white students attending non-white segregated schools in the central cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul jumped from 12% in 1992 to 75% in 2002. So a very big increase, the central cities particularly, but the metropolitan area as a whole. I'm going to show you some maps of Minneapolis. And Minneapolis, these are the elementary schools of Minneapolis. And I'm going to show you the race and poverty figures and talk about how race and poverty are both linking together in central city schools. The size of these circles is the number of children in the schools. So the larger the circle, the larger the percentage of kids, the larger the number of kids. The race is the pie chart. American Indians and are identified as green in this pie chart. Asian Pacific Islanders are orange. Hispanic are yellow. Black is red, and white is blue. And what you'll see in this map, I'm going to show you a time series from 1999 to the present. You'll see the schools in the core city of Minneapolis and the south side becoming majority Latino and Black, losing pretty much all their white children. The schools in the north side becoming majority Black. And while they were mixed with Asian kids, you're seeing the Asian kids declining as a share. You'll also see a rapid loss of schools. Rapid closing. This is often related to schools that are becoming very, very segregated in the country. When schools become very racially and socially segregated, there's often very striking declines in enrollment. And certainly this has happened in Minneapolis. This is, if you look at the chart, and I think we've supplied some of this for the committee, you can see 1999 to 2000, 2000 to 2001, 2001 to 2002, 2002 to 2003. You can also see the schools on the far southwest side of Minneapolis are majority white and becoming whiter. You can see the particular in the southwest side, 2002 to 2003, 2003 to 2004. And this is 2004 to 2005, 2005 to 2006. So you're really rapidly seeing in Minneapolis the patterns in many larger, older cities experienced decades ago, with really disastrous results for kids and communities. This is free lunch, and this is one of the most important things. I think people often talk about racial integration as just a matter of kids sitting next to each other in a classroom, but black and Latino poor kids overwhelmingly go to socioeconomically poor schools because of racial segregation. White poor children are much less likely to have that happen because of systematic discrimination in housing markets, placement of affordable housing, the way that school boundaries are drawn. Black and Latino kids that are poor face a very different world than white kids that are poor, although white kids that are poor have big challenges too. But you can see the poverty rates in these schools as they lose all their white students, become also virtually all poor. 99 to 2000, 2000 to 2001, 2001 to 2002. And you can see in the southwestern quadrant of the city, as the schools become whiter, they also become much more middle class, and they lose their percentage of poor kids, 2003 to 2004, 2004 to 2005. And again, these things are locked together. Race and poverty are locked together at the hip in schools, and this is a very big part of achievement gap and a very big part of kids' opportunity. It isn't the whole story, but it is a very significant part. This is the northern suburbs, and I'm going to look at these same maps in the Osseo School District and the Robbinsdale School District. And you see over time very much the same kinds of relationships. In the older core part of the region, you see schools becoming majority African-American and Asian, and also becoming majority poor. And you'll see these same patterns occurring. Some people think this is a central city versus suburban issue, but it's very much the older suburbs are very much experiencing the same patterns of racial and social segregation that the cities began to experience a decade ago. 95 to 96, 96 to 97, 97 to 98, 98 to 99, 99 to 2000, 2000 to 2001. And you can see particularly the formation of really more than a dozen majority-minority schools in the older suburbs, 2000 to 2003, 2003 to 2004, 2004 to 2005, and 2005 to 2006, very similar to the patterns that occurred a generation before in Minneapolis. Free lunch, and again, you can see this pattern over the years. As race and poverty concentrate in these schools, you can see that they are also becoming majority poor schools, and majority poor schools have less opportunity in this metropolitan area and throughout the country. This is the southern suburbs, Richfield and East Bloomington, and you can see these same patterns from the same period. Look at Richfield as the square box on top. Bloomington is the larger district below, 96 to 97, 97 to 98, 98 to 99, 99 to 2000, 2000 to 2001, 2001 to 2002, 2002 to 2003, 2003 to 2004 and beyond. And you can see this is the last data that we have, and you can see places like Valley View Elementary School and Indian Mounds Elementary School very much different in racial composition than the schools on the east side of Bloomington. This is the free lunch map, and again, the pattern is remarkably repetitive. Race and poverty are locked at the hip together to diminish opportunity for kids of color. Valley View Elementary, you can see three-quarters of students poor, changing several points a year. We looked at affordable housing, and affordable housing that is the state tax credit producing affordable housing in the Twin Cities. Most of the family units are built in school districts in the cities and the older suburbs with a very high minority and poverty composition. So public policy in terms of affordable housing is reinforcing rather than alleviating these patterns. Testing. We looked at the most recent tests that are available in the metropolitan area, and the tests are very much related to poverty composition. And poverty composition in the school is very correlated with test performance. And as schools go through this social, racial, and economic transition, race and poverty are locked at the hip together, and often test scores as well. Although many of the suburban districts that are diverse now, because they are not overwhelmingly poor, are doing a little better. You can see the Brooklyn Park and Brooklyn Center. This is the percentage of students with proficient scores on the reading portion of the MCA assessment test by elementary school in 2006 and 7. The red schools are 0 to 35%, which are in the core and many of the first ring suburbs. You can see the second tier, 36 to 62%. 62 to 71% are light orange, and the dark blue are much further out, particularly schools that don't have a high percentage of poor kids. This is the Osseo and Robbinsdale School District. We looked at the racial and economic change, and you can see the test scores reflected, some of the older inner suburban test scores that are very similar in terms of the test scores right across the borders in the city. The red and orange are kids that are, the red is not meet standards, the orange is partially meet standards. And this is the math portion. This is the results for the reading portion of Richfield and East Bloomington. And you can see the test scores in Richfield and East Bloomington, a little more than half of the kids in Richfield International Elementary either did not meet the standards or partially meet the standards. You can see Valley View and some of the schools on the other side of Bloomington performing better than the ones in Richfield, but still challenged compared to the schools on the other side of the city. Basic skills test, percentage of 10th graders that are passing the writing portion of the basic skills test. You can see the high schools that are strongly segregated by race and class showing the lowest test scores. And one of the important points that I'd like to make is that the concentration of poor kids in profoundly or schools that are more and more isolated has independent effects on test scores. Besides the kids, the social background that kids are coming. And it has particular strong effects in the social science literature about whether kids will graduate and go to college and beyond. And you can see this pattern is the most strongest in the poorest neighborhoods of the central cities, but the relationships hold up in the older suburbs, too. They are right behind. Dropout rates. We looked at the dropout rates. This is one of the things that's most powerfully related to racial and social segregation in the country. Robert Balfonce at the University of Rochester wrote a study about dropouts in America, and he calls racially and socially segregated schools dropout factories. And dropouts are strongly influenced by who your parents are and what they bring to the school and what the schools can do, but they're also strongly affected by your peer group. And as a peer group becomes overwhelmingly poor, and as kids aren't connected to kids that are succeeding and going on, dropout rates go up. And they go up in part because of the isolation that kids are experiencing. This is the dropout rates. You can see, again, these maps are kind of all the same maps in some ways. They show similar statistics. They have different captions, but a lot of these things fit together. Completion rates, this is another way of looking at dropout rates. We tried to use the state-reported dropout rates by the Department of Education and map those, and also completion rates, which are the number of kids that enter in ninth grade minus the number of kids that are there in 12th grade, that finish in 12th grade. And this is a way that social scientists sometimes double-check public statistics to see whether they're tracking. Dropout rates often become political things in states, and they have a variety of ways to calculate them that are different sometimes from linear analysis of kids going through schools. But these are just two ways. One is the dropout rate reported by the State Department of Education. The other is the number of kids that enter ninth grade minus the number of the kids that graduate in 12th grade. And they're just different ways of thinking about the same subject. Asthma rates. A lot of those are highly concentrated. Health disparities are related to racial and social segregation in neighborhoods and schools. Prison population. In Texas and Florida, recent studies of the prison populations have shown that segregated high schools are one of the more powerful predictors of future incarceration, independent, powerful effects. Again, peer group effects. When kids drop out, when they don't have connections to the broader society, they're much more likely to get in trouble. And segregated schools are another independent piece of this puzzle when kids don't have that peer group or connections or broader economy. And we looked at the people that had been convicted of felonies across the metropolitan area. And our data, we haven't done the same analysis they've done in Texas and Florida, but it looks a lot like the broad outlines of it look a lot like what's going on in Texas and Florida. Crimes reported in schools. One of the other things that happens, social science literature suggests that kids in really socially and racially segregated schools often experience really significantly different systems in terms of violence and in terms of what they're facing in life. Our statistics show that the kids in racially and socially segregated schools have violence as a barrier to learning, too. And this is a relationship that holds through throughout the country, and it's becoming more true here. Charter schools. One of the pieces on the table that we talked about in terms of trying to deal with the problems of social and racial disparity are charter schools. Charter schools, in our analysis of looking at this, are more racially and socially segregated than the public schools. And they are not subject to the same rules about race and class that the public schools are, and often are marketing themselves as culturally specific schools. You have a situation where the charter schools are almost twice as racially segregated as the public schools, and they're often competing for enrollment with the public schools. So the public schools are more and more considering building racially isolated schools to compete with the charter schools for enrollment. So you see a real race to by public policy, both with the charter schools and the public schools, to create more racially isolated schools. And racially isolated schools in the United States have never had a really good track record in terms of producing good outcomes for kids. These are the charter schools of the metropolitan area. You can see a number of them are all black. And there are some all-Latino charter schools. There are some all-black charter schools right next to nearly all-white charter schools. They're separate school districts for purposes of the school desegregation rule. And they're growing very fast as kids' experience have really desperate troubles with the segregated public system of education. They're often open for whatever alternatives are on the table. And these charter schools are a very rapidly growing part of the system of education of Central City kids. This is the distribution of students in non-charter schools by race, and you can see that the public schools are overwhelmingly white in the metropolitan area. This is the second whitest of the 25 largest metropolitan areas of the country. You can see charter schools are really different, and the fastest growing places enrollment in charter schools are black and Latino kids. These are charter schools that have closed for misappropriation of funds in the Central City schools. There are about 8 of them that we could find in the data. This is an issue which may be happening in public schools too. There isn't the kind of there is a more of a public process in terms of public schools. There's certainly not evidence of this, but charter schools, because of lack of oversight and lack of structure, this has happened quite a bit, a number of times. These are the test scores of the charter schools, and we only have test scores for about half of the charter schools that we could find in the state testing data. Half of them are not reporting test scores for a variety of reasons. I don't know the scope of this, but we have about half of them. And you can see the charter schools have the red parts of the segment does not meet standards. The orange partially meets standards. Light blue meets standards, and blue exceeds standards. In our looking at the data, the charter schools, if you compare the poverty populations in the schools, this is a map that shows the relationship, and it's a very strong relationship between the percentage of kids in poverty and the test scores. We looked at the charter schools, and they are more often under the line than above the line. So they are underperforming the public schools in terms of their percentage of poor kids. Some of them are above. There's a few that are above the line. You can see 3 in this case of math that are above the line, but a much larger number are below the line in terms of kids of color and in terms of the poverty percentage. The same is true in reading. There are a few that are above the line, and the majority are below the line. So if you look at the percentage of poor kids, public schools are doing a little bit better. They're both not doing very well in a racially and socially segregated setting. They're doing a little bit better than the charters. This is one of the things I think that I'd like to leave this is the relationship about schools and public policy. This is a boundary line that for many years existed in the Apple Valley-Rosemount School District.
And you can see Cedar Park Elementary had for many years, up until a few months ago, a discontiguous school boundary. So it was it had a circle around a trailer park where a large share of Latinos live, and it was connected to another part of the city where there were apartment buildings and affordable housing where Black and Latino families live. And the kids went across a couple of school attendance areas, and this created a more deep pattern of racial and social segregation in the school district. You have another school district a little bit further over, the Shannon Park, where there are two largely white neighborhoods that skip over a Latino and African American neighborhood. And these are some of the ways that school districts can enhance integration or make it worse. The Eden Prairie School District draws its boundary in ways that make school integration more likely to happen. This is an example of how things can happen that make it less likely to happen. Parts of the things that you can think about in terms of this pattern is how do the metropolitan school districts relate to each other? How many children have the choice, particularly African-American and Latino kids, have the choice to go to schools that have strong scores and strong connections? There are some programs that allow kids to make choices, to choose more socially integrated schools. Across the country, these have had some pretty good outcomes. Also thinking about what the rules are for drawing school boundaries and whether schools should be free to draw boundaries that make schools more segregated or whether they should be encouraged to draw boundaries that make them more integrated. This is a question that you have, how the districts cooperate with each other, how the school funding system encourages kids to go to school together rather than to go to school apart. A lot of this is included in this research report, The Choice is Ours, that is on the website at the Institute for Race and Poverty. This work has been supported by the broad variety of philanthropies, the Ford Foundation, and a number of local philanthropies. We're working together to try to refine this message in conjunction with the Urban League, African American Family Services, Central Campesino, and HACER. Housing Preservation Project, so thinking about not only from a raw academic point and the numbers, looking at the data and the results and the boundaries, but also trying to work with communities going forward to understand how they're experiencing this really rapidly growing social and racial divide in the metropolitan area.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask the senators, and I think we have just Senator Carlson at the table. I have a few questions that I would like to ask you. I had an opportunity to meet with some teachers and some individuals who are working in Hennepin County right now, Rosita Balch and Norma Garces, who are here, really trying to figure out how do we work on these issues collectively, which is what Senator Erickson Robes alluded to at the beginning of the hearing, because we clearly see that we can't really look at this issue of academic performance in isolation, that we really need to look at the different factors that contribute to the achievement gap. A question that this group of experts asked me was, Senator, if you are to put funding and efforts into housing, for instance, so that we can give these children and these families an opportunity to live in those areas where there are more resources, where schools have more resources to respond to their needs. How do we really make that happen? Do you have the power to really say, okay, now we have low-income housing in this area, and therefore it should happen? I think their answer was, we don't think that you can do that. I think that you need to think about a very concrete and a specific effort that help families make that decision by themselves, because we cannot create these communities, because legislatively we are mandating that people live this way. So people have to find ways to really adopt this as a priority and say, yeah, we want to live in this community, and then if housing is available to us, we will move there. What is your response to that? How do we work from a legislative point of view? Because it seems that here we can look at funding for housing, for instance. It occurs to me that's something that we can really take a look at it. But how do we motivate people, and how do we open that opportunity to families so that they seek that opportunity and they pursue those resources that we could make available to those families?
I think in terms of housing, Senator, there have been many good programs that have tried to provide a variety of housing types throughout the metropolitan area. Montgomery County, Maryland, has one of the best in the country. They try to make sure that new developments, when they are developed, have about 15% market rate affordable and 5% subsidized. And Montgomery County, Maryland, has had one of the most socially and racially integrated schools on the East Coast. They've been a high-performing, high-income place. It's a very prosperous place, and a lot of people, because of it's a small percentage of affordable housing that each community builds little by little. Very few residents really know about the program or are troubled by it. In the Twin Cities metropolitan area from 1970 till 1982, this metropolitan area operated one of the most proactive affordable housing programs in the country, and it was administered by the Met Council. It was called Policy 1339. And as communities developed, they received a large share of the existing resources for affordable housing. That was that time at the project-based Section 8. And that housing today, there's about 11,000 units that are scattered throughout places like Eden Prairie and Minnetonka and Apple Valley and Edina. Not so much Edina, but many communities on the fringe of the region. And it was very proactive. About half of the households that live in that housing today are minority families. And this was a model of one of the most effective programs. Portland, Oregon has a pretty good affordable housing program. Seattle, Washington has a good affordable housing program that provides affordable housing. There are over 100 communities in the country that do inclusionary housing. But if you look at these programs, none was as effective as the one that we operated, or the Twin Cities operated, between 1970 and 82. Today, this has changed. Where we used to really concentrate on the developing area, we are allocating a lot of the tax credit resources that produce affordable housing into the poorest neighborhoods of the central cities. And the central cities, the CDCs in the central city of Minneapolis are doing about as much affordable housing as all the suburbs combined, in fact, more. And the public sector is doing a lot more, if you think about the public sector in Minneapolis. So this could support a more integrated approach. This is a very, very affluent, very white region. It could make progress in a big hurry on these issues.
Thank you. We now are going to open. Thank you for your presentation.
You.
We would like to provide an opportunity. We're trying to change the way we do I am not going to say business, but we're going to try to really look at new models of getting input from the community and responding to questions from the community. What we attempted to do today was really to open the conversation and to invite many people in the community to be part of this conversation. So what we would like to do now is that for those who are here who would like to give an opinion or provide a comment about these presentations, we would like to hear your comment. We would like to hear your input. Obviously, our offices are open, and you can provide that comment, that input, anytime, and call me or send me an email. We are looking at three more hearings of this committee. I would like to hear from you as to where do you think we need to go in terms of listening to presentations from people, individuals, organizations that are doing significant work that we need to bring here. And early childhood education, as I said in the beginning, is really an area where we would like to go and hear more about. But the issues that we heard from the superintendents today are really clear. What we hear is that we need to invest in strong school leadership, and certainly teacher quality is an issue that has been researched, and we hear more and more that teachers do make a difference, and that when we provide the opportunities, a teacher can make a big difference, even when we control for poverty and ethnicity and many other issues. We heard about engaged and involved caregivers, very important aspect of how do we work with parents, how do we work with caregivers to make sure that they are active participants in this process. We heard about high school reform initiatives, and that is something that was repeated by all of the superintendents and that we hear more and more from people who have called us. We also hear this constantly, and that is high expectations and delivering a message of what do we expect from our kids and how do we teach this message of you have control over your future, which is what Dr. Green talked about, really working with our kids and figuring out how do we deliver this message, how do we engage our kids, and how do we create high expectations in our districts and our schools. School funding, this is an issue that clearly I hear from all of you. We know the answers. We have the evidence, we have the research that clearly shows specific steps that we need to take. So what would it take to take Minnesota to act in that direction? Clearly, this is something that I am attempting to do as co-chair of this committee, and that is the reason we have invited you, because we believe that you have the answers, that you can provide clear information as to what do we need to do and where do we need to go from now. I think the big question that remains to be answered is how do we get there? What does it take to get the state of Minnesota, to be at a place where we can look at statistics that apply to all children? So when we look at child well-being, when we look at achievement, and we look how well we're doing in the state of Minnesota and how well white children are doing, when are we going to be able to say all children in the state of Minnesota are doing well? And then building on strengths, which is something that Senator Saltzman really talked about, we know that there are things that work. We are a model state. So how do we use that information, and how do we build on the strengths that we have? These and other issues are issues that we're going to be reviewing, and I would like to invite all of you to contact my office to give us information about individuals, programs, initiatives that we should contact to hear about. The microphones are yours. I am going to be here until I need to be here. So if you have a comment about these presentations, if you would like to ask us to go in a specific direction, we would like to hear from you.
Senator.
Good afternoon. Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm John Pupart. I'm a Chippewa Indian, Anishinaabe in my way. I'm here as the president of the American Indian Policy Center. We examine issues from our cultural dimension as Native peoples. And I'm pleased to appear before your committee, which you wisely put together on this phenomenon known as the achievement gap. This achievement gap goes back a long way for Native peoples. The treaties with the U.S. government and Indian tribes developed a thing called the trust responsibility. Excuse me. Trust responsibility took into consideration that Indian peoples gave up millions and millions of acres of land for use by non-Indian people. And a part of that bargain was that the United States government would look after the social, educational, health, and economic needs of Native people. Not too many people learn this in our educational systems, by the way. Only later in higher education, perhaps, and through experience, do they come upon these anecdotal pieces of information. But it's really clear to us that the government needs to address still the educational needs of Native people. And as I listened today to the efforts put forth by the state and local systems of education, it reaffirms my my understanding that education is locked within itself, and it has a limited ability to think outside of the box, or even to dare act outside of the box. And that's the issue as it comes to Innan people. Policies were developed throughout the ages regarding education of Innan people, going way back in the 1800s, where acts were passed by Congress regarding the education. And even in 1972, Congress enacted the Indian Education Act. And for our purposes here today, Minnesota also adopted an Indian Education Act in 1988, which created several of the Indian schools throughout the state. So there have been a great deal of attention paid to the structural parts of education as it affects Indian people. And when I started to go to college, there were 5% of us who had higher education degrees here in Minnesota. That tells you how far I go back. But even today, it's still less than 30% of us. So education hasn't really, you know, had the traction that we believed that it would. And the Indian folks who did become educated, who did acquire degrees, and now many more of us have PhDs and masters in specialized education. But we're still having the same kind of problems that we were in 1972. We were talking about the lack of graduation, the dropout rates, the absenteeism, the achievement gap. Of course, we still have those numbers, and those are the same cause for action as they were then, 35 years ago. So something isn't working, and that's kind of where I come into the room, and I'm saying, well, there are plenty of folks who can take care of the data picture, who can look at the political side of this, the policy side. But I think the strongest thing that I bring is the cultural aspect, that we are, you know, we can't teach what we don't know. That's the bottom line. And we don't know about the cultural makeup of Indian nations, Indian families, the extended family. And these are the things that drive attitude and behavior. These are the things that entice people to go forth and accept challenges. And this is what is needed by bring our families closer to the education spectrum. So when we talk about strategic planning, we tend to go back into the old structure of how you customarily do strategic planning. It's very linear, compartmentalized, and sequential, which is counter to the way that Indian people think through things. Our worldview, our philosophy is more global, holistic in nature, and it's failed to interface with the educational systems. So the information I'm trying to bring you today is, let's fix the system, of course. And fixing the system doesn't mean doing the same thing that you've been doing, but only doing it better, because it still doesn't work out in the community that I represent. It still lacks that traction. Where the rubber meets the road, it isn't working. We still have the absenteeism rates, for example, in kids. You know, like 37% of our kids miss 30 days or more of school each year. You know, and we don't really reach out to try and involve the school with the parents. we rather develop another policy or another law called Truancy Intervention Program TIPS, which is sanction-oriented. We don't work at the problem. We punish the problem doers. And I dare say that that creates more fodder for our correctional institutions. So the collateral kind of results of what's happening in policy, trying to be more punitive, doesn't really work out. It doesn't achieve the desired results. So I'm pushing forth the ideas here today that there is a kind of research that needs to be done with our communities. It hasn't been done yet. We're trying to discover how Indian people can become stakeholders in the educational system. And we're trying to figure out how the principals and the teachers and other staff of school systems can be more culturally competent in the Native communities. We can only do that together, and the research needs to be also in partnership. We can't have the scientific paradigm of research come into our communities and to discover the kinds of things that really need to be discovered. There has to be an interpretation, and it takes the participation of Indian people to make that interpretation effective so that it's understood back and forth. I feel like a lonely voice in this midst of hierarchy of education and skilled people and politically powerful people. But reminds me of an old song by Chris Christopherson that says, if you keep on talking to the people who don't listen, who's going to care in the end? So that's the kind of thing that I feel I'm up against, but it's the same message that I'm repeating again and again, that we have to have this kind of partnership, and we have to have a place at the table for our parents, for our community members, because that's what will make it work. And I could go on and on about the data and all those measurements of failure. We all know that that's there. But I was hoping to bring a message to some of us who are willing to go that way.
Thank you so much, Mr. Poupart. And I have to say to you, as in a personal note, you have been one of my mentors, and obviously you have my commitment to ensure that your voice is not going to be a lonely voice. I made an effort to invite the councils and the ombudspersons and you and many others who are here. I have heard that from many people in the American Indian community and communities of color that we are not extending an invitation to you, and that we have not made an effort to include your message in the work that we do here at the legislature. And I am attempting to change that. And so I am very pleased that you're here, and I hope that I've learned from you during the last 18 years, and I will continue to learn from you and hope that together we can find some answers. Clearly, the legislature, the Senate, and the House will not be able to find all the answers and do all the work. We cannot do it without you. And so I'm very honored that you're here and that you're willing to work with us. This is going to be a long journey, so thank you for Senator Salzman has a question.
Yes, just a question and comment, if I may, Madam Chair. One of the things that I think is important that we have a shared goal, and that it's not just schools or it's not just the state, but, you know, the role of families and parents. And if we don't have that same shared goal of what we want to achieve, it's going to be hard for us to get there or reach the higher mark. I was at the Hiawatha Leadership Academy when it opened, and the one thing I carry from that is the statement from the principal of we will do whatever it takes to make sure these children achieve. And one of the things I think that becomes at times frustrating is that to say if teachers or if schools or if legislator is to make sure that parents are also doing whatever it takes to make sure their kids achieve. And that goes back to the shared goal is if I don't have high expectations for my child, is it going to happen? And that's, I think, what we hear from other, you know, from other sides of this issue of this is a black hole, we're never going to put enough money into it, is how can we really make sure that we're all working together, all the stakeholders are involved. And that makes it easier for us. But if you, as we go forward to talk about how can we make sure that parents, that we're doing whatever we can to make sure we support them, because they're such an important part of making sure that their children achieve as well.
Oh, yeah. And thank you for that comment and partial question, because I agree with you absolutely that a shared goal, shared mission is the way to recovery, and we can all work toward that together. The thing that's really been missing simply has been a venue for this kind of discussion over time. You either have it happen in the inner community, or either you go into the school district, and each one of those has its own umbrella of authority, its own structure, either side of that. What we need is a moderating venue to have an honest dialogue about the points that each or everybody brings to the table to work toward those goals. Yeah, the inner community, I would say, is eager to have those test scores elevated, those grades up, and those competencies acquired and attendance improved. Yeah, I think I bring that message here. They would want to see that same. Everyone wants to see that same kind of progress. So I think together we can make this happen. I would suggest that the first thing is figure out how do we get the venue to have that kind of honest dialogue.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else from the audience? Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself.
David Zander, Research Analyst, Council, Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And I think some of the things I want to say really reiterate what John has just said from the Asian community. I started as a teacher. I am an anthropologist of education. I've taught in 5 different school districts, London, Nairobi, the Bahamas, and in France, and in Minnesota. I was reminded a couple of times of some of those experiences. And I think one of the issues that I really find myself head-on with the superintendent from St. Paul is when she says that cultural diverse curriculums are a threat to integration. Now, I think we might explore. But let me take the story when I was a teacher in London, my first year. And Malcolm, a little boy from Jamaica, and I realized that I really had to make my classroom friendly to Malcolm, and I really needed to understand about Jamaica and something about his culture. And that really, that kind of lack that I had as a teacher in a diverse classroom has stuck with me for 40 years. In the Bahamas, we were teaching an English literature curriculum, and at some point, an alternative curriculum was introduced that was comprised of literature from the Caribbean. So instead of doing Shakespeare, or instead of having readers about English policemen, we had stories that were from the villages that the kids could relate to throughout the Caribbean. And I do remember that we read The Pearl by Steinbeck, which was the plot of that the kids could really relate to. And so I think thinking along those lines of curriculum, we've got to make the curriculum really relating to the kids from all these different communities. We have 44 Asian communities. We're not at square one. At the Council Asian Pacific, we've been doing studies, we've been doing town hall meetings, we've been doing focus groups with the communities for the last 10 years. And I want to share, maybe for Superintendent Green, a comment from that. The Hmong parents gave us lots of their input. And there's a couple of issues I have not heard on the table today. Homework help. So these reports were given to Peebles, and what the Hmong parents were saying in town hall meetings, what the Lao parents were saying, and what the Tibetan parents were saying, and many of the Tibetans live in still live in Whittier neighborhood and in South Minneapolis. They were saying, you know, and I remember it was a Lao mother that said this so clearly. She was in Lao. So we were having these meetings in the languages of the people that we were doing the focus groups with. And she said, first of all, she said, 17 years here, this is the first opportunity that I've had to express my feelings about my children and my grandchildren's education. But they said, you know, we need help with homework. We don't know the math that our kids are learning here. They were needing a lot of literacy help. So she really wanted to see the schools take a more positive role with helping the kids. And I think related to this is having the school day longer so that there would be homework halls, there would be homework time after school. And I think that really, really would increase the level of proficiency of the kids in these inner city schools, the homework help. Another issue that came up a lot was truancy. And from the perspective of how slow it is for the schools to let the parents know that their kids are truant. And there was one case, I mean, I hope it's been improved upon, but a Hmong parent would say, you know, my kid was absent Tuesday. I got to hear about it Sunday night on an automated telephone call to our family saying that my kid was truant Tuesday. And if the parent did not understand English, they wouldn't get the message. Or if a kid picked up, they wouldn't get the message. So we were saying something much, much different needed to be done to work with the parents. The parents wanted their kids in school, and they wanted better communication with the schools. So we're at the council. We're here to help you have these conversations. I want to give the example of Representative Melissa Hortman, who's a key advocate on education. She said, how can I have a better relationship with my constituents? And we have helped to have town hall meetings in Lao and in Hmong so that the communities can bring their concerns. And, you know, we said, first the question was, how can I get these groups to my town hall meetings? And we said, well, that won't happen. But if you have a special town hall meeting on this issue. I was at Patrick Henry High School this week, and another point here is they have a very successful Asian club there, and there were 50 bright first years there. And one of the things I asked them, I said, I've got to get school approval, but I'd like to come back and do a focus group with you about dropout prevention. And this is an initiative that we're trying to assist Camilleri with MDE. So there is, we've heard from the kids before, but we want to do these listening sessions throughout the community to hear from the kids, you know, why did they drop out? What got them back in school? Why did their peers drop out? Or the opposite, because some people say, well, I don't know a kid that's dropped out. Then what helped that kid stay in school? And I'm very much aware, you know, we've heard from Myron about the differences between the suburban and the inner school. But I'm very interested in tracking two kids in the same school. What is it that one who came here at 8 years old has a degree in law and is now the director of our council, Eileen Herr, and a peer who dropped out? So what is the story? And I know from the research that I did that it is people that make a difference. So I think the staff that run those Asian clubs, the grandparents that come in and mentor, so mentoring is a big thing. So that caring adults for every child.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And I want to make sure that you know that we will have more opportunities to talk about specific efforts. So we have three more hearings. I think we have time only for one more person. Thanks again for your comments. Yes, please. If you could introduce yourself and start your comments.
Thank you very much. My name is Rosita. I'm here as a parent. I'm not here as a worker of any entity. I'm just a parent and a learner, full-time learner. Thank you very much for providing this space for us to learn and know where our children are as far as education. I just have a couple of comments, and I think you as a mother know that a child not only learns in the classroom, it's not only the responsibility of the parent or the teacher. The well-being and the academic success of a kid. And I think there are so many ways that the state need to approach the issue of the achievement gap. We have parks, we have neighborhoods, we have after-school programs, and every single person should be at the table talking about that. Our kids are being raised by TV, and we need appropriate programs for our kids. If I walk in the Mall of America and I see a kid that is lost, I'll try to take that kid where he or she belongs. And it's the same with our kids lost in the system. We need programs appropriate for our children. From cultural is specific, there are many kids that come from very rich countries in terms of culture background. They don't even know what is happening, who are the leaders of those countries. They don't know the reality why their parents are here. A kid, in order to learn, needs to feel happy and secure and safe. And I want to ask you, how can our kids could be open to learn where they're so fearful of an immigration raid? Will I have my mom when I finish the school day or not? So that is a big issue that it needs to be addressed specifically with our Latino kids. And going back to the our conversation that we had in the past about housing and low income and poverty and race, we need to address also jobs for the parents. If parents have to work 3 or 4 jobs, they're not going to be able to help with any homework. They're not going to be able to go to a school ever. So I think it's a chain of events and issues that need to be addressed. And if you're going to prepare more hearings, I think it's very important that daycare providers, after-school programs, are here at the table. And we need to evaluate their programs. What are they doing for our immigrant kids? Are they helping them, really, or what is it? Are the kids participating? If they're not participating, why is that? So I really appreciate this opportunity, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Balch. We really appreciate that you're here to provide testimony. I have to ask the senators if you have time for one more testimony. We are supposed to finish at 4, and I want to make sure that I respect your time. One more? Okay. We have time for one more. Please welcome. Introduce yourself. And
yes, I'm Barbara Behrman. I'm on the board of the DFL Education Foundation, and we have been holding meetings exploring the issue of the achievement gap, and we were lucky enough to have Myron at one of those meetings. And I was wondering if we could get more information from him that he shared with us in terms of the effect of districts that have a wider attendance area or that are configured in a more county or metropolitan way, and the effect of that on stability for housing and also stability for school attendance. In the end, the legislature holds the responsibility and the power to configure school districts in this state. And so I was just wondering if we could hear more from Myron, or if there's a time limit right now, or if you could at least get that on your mental schedule to bring that issue before your committee.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for your invitation. I want you to know, I want the audience to know that this is, again and again, the beginning of the conversation. We need to explore every venue, and we need to hear, because from all people who have done the research that has, you know, really evidence-based research, I think the process that we are developing is attempting to bring these conversations kind of really in a very briefly for right now and touch on the issues and then come up with the recommendations from this committee as to where do we need to put our resources and energy to get two or three recommendations, because certainly this is an issue that affects many districts and that many senators are very interested in working on, and representatives. So this is really to touch on the surface of these issues, and we will get back to kind of the specifics. So we will have other opportunities in the future to get back to that more in-depth conversation about this. And I think part of the struggle right now, as you will hear as we invite other people in the future, is that when we bring some of the people that are working right now, for instance, with the strategic planning process with the Minneapolis School District, you will hear that a lot of the work that the McKinsey Group is doing really focuses on academic performance and what the schools need to do. I think what people are telling us right now is that we have a tremendous responsibility here at the legislature to focus our efforts and resources into education, and that we have neglected to do that, that we have not put enough resources into that. And then I think the community overall is saying, well, that cannot be done in isolation. We need to look at housing. We need to look at healthcare. Dr. Myers will be here, hopefully, for the next presentation to look at attendance. So he's, as you know, have done extensive research in this. So again, this is the beginning, and we're hoping that we can come back to specific issues and talk about them in more.
Yeah. Well, as a citizen and as a taxpayer, I want to support your efforts in really digging into making systemic changes. And also, I would like to be challenged as a citizen to what the issues are and to be challenged to step up to the plate. And I think we need to be spending more on education, period. We need more adults working with kids. And if we're really serious, if we care about kids in this state, and we care about the future, then we have to pay for it.
Absolutely. So. Thank you. Thank you so much for your message. Senator Salzman has some comments.
So just in response to that last comment, I think it's easier for us to make the case for additional funding, Madam Chair, when we have very specific programs that we know work. Instead of this, well, they're throwing more money at education, it's we're putting money into targeted programs that we know have been successful. And if we have the data to back those up, I think it even makes our case stronger. And that's what I hope will come out of this. And so giving us just more data makes our life sometimes really confusing if that data comes with, and we believe that this then is the solution, or this is a direction or a policy that helps us start to focus. But so thank you so much for your comments. And I have been following your work and your emails, and I really appreciate the fact that you have done such extensive notes on your hearings, because it's helped at least me be briefed for the work ahead of us.
Absolutely. Senator Carlson, do you have any final comments?
Thank you.
I just have a couple of short comments to make, and I guess that much of it has been said, especially about the two senators here. But in my case, I got involved in this business here, the legislature, to affect some changes like you're talking about. And what I'm seeing is that there's a huge number of things to do. And it's being an engineer, I'm a mathematician, and what I see is a long expression. There's a long formula here with many, many different expressions in it. And one of the expressions is the health care of children so that they can learn, getting rid of poverty so that they can learn, getting them involved in education early so that they can be prepared to learn. There are so many things that are in these expressions that brings us to the point where someone can enter the workforce, and that's really what we're talking about here. I mean, if I want to be very selfish about it, we're going to get into the workforce some people that can earn a lot of money. They can contribute to our economy, contribute to our state, contribute to our country, to our future. And we need to take it very seriously because especially some of us who are mathematicians, we do know that we have a bulge that I'm part of here that's called the baby boom. And the probably the best thing that we can do in our self-preservation is to make sure all those that follow us are as prepared as possible to bear the burden of us getting old and probably of themselves getting old. So it's I think it's a very important self-interest that we need to convince the folks that are of my age and surrounding me that we need to put as much as we can into this younger generation so that they can achieve, and not just achieve, but so that they can contribute in the future.